Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to tonight's session of Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. I want to thank the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art for their ongoing support of this program. The rise of the internet and information technology has significantly impacted the way in which many contemporary artists work and share their ideas, create new production models, and form new paths of communication and interactive communities. These kinds of approaches are often defined through the notion of open source, which is the departure topic for tonight's program. I'm thrilled that we have with us two extraordinarily interesting and prominent artists, Corey Archangel and Rafael Lozano Hemmer, who use the latest technology of video games, the web, and other virtual interfaces to pursue some of these issues of interactivity and communication, always through the prism of making impactful contemporary statements. Both Corey and Rafael will briefly present their work as it relates to this topic. They'll then join me on stage, as it were, for a conversation which we'll turn over to all of you as the evening progresses, and I hope you'll feel very free to ask them any questions that you have. Corey Archangel is a Brooklyn-based artist who works with video, installation, music, composition, sculpture, print media, the web, and mathematics. His installation and sculptural work has been exhibited internationally in such venues as the Whitney Biennial, the Liverpool Biennial, here at the Museum of Modern Art, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, the Migros Museum for Gegenwartkunst in Zurich, and many other places. Among his upcoming projects is a solo show of new work at the University of Michigan Museum of Art in the fall of this year. Rafael Lozano Hemmer was born in Mexico City in 1967. 1989, he received a degree in physical chemistry from Concordia University in Montreal, if I could put a plug in, one of the great, great cities and universities in North America. He's an artist who works with kinetic sculpture, video installation, and photography to develop large-scale interactive installations, especially in public spaces, usually deploying the newest technologies and custom-made physical interfaces. His work is in the collections of the Museum of Modern Art and the Tate, among many other places, and has been shown in dozens of countries and many biennials worldwide, including Venice, Istanbul, Havana, Sydney, and Seoul. He's had a number of major commissions, including the Millennium Celebrations in Mexico City in 1999, the Cultural Capital of Europe in Rotterdam in 2001, and the United Nations World Summit of Cities in Lyon in 2003. Please join me in welcoming first Corey and then Rafael.
Okay. Hold on a sec. Okay.
Sorry, I have to kill the music.
Oh, okay.
I have, Sorry about that. We're back.
No problem. Okay. Thank you. The kind of, in the description of this, event, there was the phrase, artwork which uses electronic databases, and that is where I was going to jump off from. So I kind of compiled a bunch of things I've made over the past 8 or 9 years of all the different ways that I've been working around that area. And I've, so I'm just going to go through them. It's going to be pretty quick, and yeah, that's that. So I canned this. This is if you're wondering how this is happening, it's all recorded earlier today. And I've never done this, so we're going to try it out. So most of the things I'm going to show today are works that I've made online or works that can only exist online. I think maybe one or two are works that can exist in real spaces. And I like events like these for online work. Of course, exists great online, but it always often has a trouble coming into real spaces, and I think events like this are really appropriate ways to present them and talk about them. All right, so the first project I'm going to show is a project called Pizza Party, and I made it in 2004 at a collaboration with a programmer named Michael Fruman. And Pizza Party is a command line text-based software package for ordering pizza or for throwing pizza parties. So for those of you that remember DOS, you know, when you used to turn on your computer, it would just be a little green prompt, and you could type in some stuff and things would happen. Well, Pizza Party is basically a program.
Here we
that
are,
works...
Michael Fruman, programmer of Pizza Party.
Yo.
And
a program that works in that environment, similar environment, but it allows you to order pizzas from Domino's. So,
where?
Yeah,
to
we'll
order
watch
pizza.
This.
Why don't we take a look at the help file?
Okay, here we go.
Here is the syntax of Pizza right. Party. Yeah.
The program.
Uh-huh.
The options.
Uh-huh.
How many pizzas, what size, and what kind of crust?
All right, so let's take a look at the flags. Here's username, password for your Domino's account. Input file, which allows you to order pizzas in batch if you're throwing a pizza party. Verbose, quiet, and force are typical command line arguments,
yeah,
right?
Standard Unix stuff.
Standard Unix stuff. And here's some of the flags. Onions, green peppers, mushrooms, olives, tomatoes, pineapple. Of course, if you haven't noticed yet, these are the toppings. Cheddar cheese, pepperoni, sausage, ham, bacon, ground beef, grilled chicken, anchovies, and extra sauce. So, why don't we order a pizza?
Here you go. What do you want on it?
Pepperoni.
Uh-huh.
Mushrooms.
Yep. Anything else?
No, that's cool.
How many?
Just one.
Uh-huh. What size?
Medium.
And what kind of crust?
Thin.
Thin crust. Okay, here we go.
All right, so yeah, here's our confirmation.
$12.48 is your price. You ready?
Yeah.
There you go.
All right.
On its way.
And then it bumps us back to the command line.
You know, ready for fun stuff.
Yeah, so let's see what time it is. All right, so it's 6:21. So we'll see if the pizza comes in a half hour. Oh, there we go. See if the pizza comes in a half hour. All right?
I'm hungry.
Hi.
How much you want back, my friend?
It's $12.48.
How much you want back?
$5. Ooh, thin crust. Oh, nice. I never had.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's good.
Whoa. Yeah.
So, when I first started to work on this program, I had had a bug in it. The pizza guy came, and I was really pumped, and then the pizza guy came 20 minutes later because Domino's has a... They only allow you to order pizza every 20 minutes, and it was constantly ordering pizzas, and so... but this is an actual open source program, which means the code is available, and what that means is that people are able to download it and modify it, and it's been ported to other programming language. I haven't tried it, but I read somewhere ported it for Papa John's. All right, so anyway, this one I wanted to show because it's really one of the stupidest things I've ever made, and I think that's appropriate. I always like to show it. It's called Doogle, D-O-O-O-G-L-E, and it is a version of Google that only searches for Doogie Howser. And so it is doogle.com. And there's really nothing more to say about that. but I like to, you know, as you saw with Pizza Party, I like to deploy kind of like fairly complex technologies that have no purpose or use, value. I would say that's something I've been interested in for a long time. And do go, like, 5 people a month go to it. It is absolutely like a total disaster in terms of interest. All right, so next, I wanted to talk about a performance I did because the description mentioned Facebook and stuff. So does anyone remember Friendster? Raise your hand if you remember what Friendster was. Friendster was the first big online, well, in my life at least, the first social network that became really popular. And now, of course, it's Facebook. And a couple years ago, it was MySpace. When did I do this performance? Whatever, like maybe 4 years ago, Friendster was absolutely like, you know, the New Yorker articles were rolling out, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And I just did a performance where I invited people to come, and it was called Friendster Suicide, and I just deleted my Friendster account as part of the performance, which it's almost time for me to delete my MySpace account, I have to be honest. It's almost time for a MySpace suicide. So I invited people, and you could either come and watch it. It was at PS1, or I thought that you could just watch it online, and I figured that if you just kept refreshing your friend list, eventually I would just disappear when I ended up doing the performance. So, yeah, that's that. Okay, so what's next? Friendster. Oh, okay. Well, the next project I want to talk about, I don't know why I was staying on this morning when I did this surfing. I think I thought it was more interesting than it was. okay, well, the next project I'm going to present goes by a couple different names, and one is Punk Rock 101, and the other name, it's Kurt Cobain's Suicide Letter versus Google Ads. And I think it was 2005. I can't remember when I made it, 2006. I made a webpage that had nothing but Kurt Cobain's Suicide Letter, and then I put Google Ads in it. And Google Ads, of course, are ads which are generated off of the text of the page that they appear on. And you could see here, the ads were quite apt, I guess. Social anxiety treatment, natural writing solutions, public speaking fear. Google eventually found out about the site and took it down, and these are some screenshots from it. But so every time you would go to it, the ads would change, but they would be all very, it was pretty good. The way the ads worked, and I made money because they're ads, and so there are the checks that Google sent me before it got taken down, because I think they thought it was a terms of use violation, but one of these days I'd like to sneak it back up on the internet. The next, I don't know what, let's see what's going to happen next. All right, okay, so I don't know what I was doing. This just maybe the phone rang. Let's see, where am I going to... Well, anyway, on my paper here it says the next project. So last year I did a project called A Couple Thousand Short Films about Glenn Gould, and this was a video and a book made in collaboration with... Dexter Sinister, and Film and Video Umbrella, which is a commissioning agency from the UK. And the first thing I want to show is, I'll show the video in a little bit, and I wanted to talk a little bit about an essay that I wrote in the book called On Sea, which is a pun for referencing Terry Riley's In Sea. And what On Sea is, and you'll see it in a second once I stop surfing whatever I'm doing here. I think I'm trying to find the book, but whatever. It's funny, I canned this, and I didn't do a very good job. So anyway, On Sea, what I thought, you know, as you can see, I'm kind of interested in the structures or... you know, the way that content is delivered over the internet. And this is always changing. Sometimes it's social networks, sometimes it's ads. And as the structure changes, the content changes. And this project on C was a research paper explaining the mathematics behind JPEGs. And I didn't do anything. All I did was basically write from the ground up a paper describing why JPEGs look like they do. And you could see it here. I start explaining, well, what is compression? What is the history of compression? Why do we need compression? And then I go through, which you'll see in a second, kind of in a way which is slightly more beginner-friendly than the similar documents which are available on the internet, because these documents are quite common. And this isn't very advanced mathematics. It's actually kind of high school level. But I guess what I was trying to think is... you know, I was thinking, well, you know, I've done all these projects where I kind of do these kind of funny mix-ups of technologies, and I was thinking that maybe that was no longer necessary. Maybe I would just be able to, if I were just able to explain technology, maybe that would be enough of a kind of artist gesture. So yeah, here's kind of the meth, you know, here's the kind of explanation. The Joint Photographic Experts, I don't know if anyone knows, that's what JPEG actually stands for. It's very cool. It was actually the Joint Photographic Experts Group, which JPEG was never an official name for JPEG files. It's just what people ended up calling it. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting history. It's named after a group, not... Well, whatever. Maybe it's not interesting to anybody, but... and that's the book, which it was in. And the book was made about a video, which I think I'm going to show. Oh, yes, I am going to show. The video is a recreation of Bach-Goldberg Variation Number 1, played by different clips of people playing instruments on YouTube. And in order, you know, basically what I'm doing here is I wanted to show people that pretty much what I do all day long is surf the internet, and my favorite things to surf on the internet are guitar shred videos. So I think I'm searching for one right here. And so I just want you to see that, and then you could see the video I made, which is a kind of a response. So this is what I watch all day long. This is Paul Gilbert, ex Mr. Big guitar player. You know, he didn't get much respect when he was in the band Mr. Big, but he actually is an amazing guitar player. So anyway, this is the video I made called A Couple Thousand Short Films About Glenn Gould, where I wrote a computer program. It's a piece. Oh, you'll see. So that's that. It's kind of a pastiche of Switched on Bach by Wendy Carlos Williams? Wait, Wendy? Well, I'm totally blanking. Whatever. Anyway. And the last thing I want to show... Oh, and sometimes that actually appears in real space. And that's what it looks like. The next one is going to be all cats. So, anyway. And that also, the code that I wrote to edit that video with is available in the book, because I did have to write a kind of program that would do that. And the last thing I wanted to show, I hope I'm not going too fast, but is a kind of ongoing research project which I've been doing for the last 7 or 8 years. Like I said, I surf the internet all day long. It's a problem. And this Delicious, which this is linked off my site, I keep a kind of breadcrumb trail of things that I think are interesting. A lot of people here might know Delicious. It's a pretty popular way to do this. And one of the longest genres of interesting links that I have been keeping track of is which is kind of keeping track of vernacular web design, what I like to call dirt style web design. And so I have an interest in the way that the kind of design of the web has changed over the years as the technologies have advanced, you know? And so, for example, I think I'm going to click on a nice example of this type of web design, which my friend Kendra sent me. And this, I think, is a really good example of what I'm talking about. This is what the web used to look like, you know? And I think we all remember it. And I think at this point, most of us remember it actually pretty fondly. There's so much to talk about on that page. But if you go to my links and you go to the word dirt style, you will see pretty much, you know, 5 years of me finding these sites. And actually, more interesting, if you just go to general tags dirt style on Delicious, there's a lot that other people have found too, and those are usually more interesting. This is a nice example as well, the Bo and Nico show. Animated GIFs, horizontal rule GIFs, badly compressed JPEGs, centered design, colored backgrounds. But I mean, this is one of the things that I think the web is actually the best for, is simply filtering and curating content, you know. So, you know, I haven't... Steely Dan's website? Huge. I mean, websites just don't look like this anymore. You know what I mean? It's terrible, but it's awesome. What am I trying to say? I was trying to say something serious. That's, I think, one role for people, artists but non-artists alike today. I mean, I think the way culture is going and the web is going, that's all people are going to be doing is simply sifting and curating content. And I'm excited about that. And I think we all should be excited about that. Anyway, okay, that's my presentation. So, questions later.
I'm thankful for the opportunity to be here today and meet Corey. Thanks for coming today. I have three passports. I have a Mexican passport, which is green, Canadian one, which is blue. Then I got a Spanish passport, which is red. So I have RGB, and I can color mix and choose what's necessary at a certain situation. And please don't get this the wrong way, but I've never actually desired your passport until today. Because it's so exciting. I watched it all morning, and it was just like, that is really, really awesome. I'm going to show you five projects, two old ones and three new ones. For those of you who have seen my work before, sorry about showing the two hits first, and then I'll show you three pieces from last year. I specialize in making large-scale interactive sort of platforms or interventions in public space. One of my very first breaks was for the Millennium Celebrations in Mexico City. I got the commission to transform the Zócalo Square, which, you know, instead of having like a firework event or some kind of Son Lumière show, what we did is we placed 18 searchlights in the building surrounding the Zócalo. And we measured them with GPS trackers, and then we designed this three-dimensional interface on the web for people to design their own light sculptures. So anyone could actually log on to a place called alzado.net and, in fact, visualize these searchlights and direct them, move them, and make different kinds of designs, things like pyramids or meshes or disordered sort of patterns. And then you could just visualize it with these sort of three-dimensional tools. And once you were happy with the design, you would put your name and your location, maybe a dedication, and then send it to Mexico, where over a period of 2 weeks, every night, from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., the designs would arrive from the internet and get actually realized by the searchlights in the night sky. So this is, for instance, a scene at 3 in the morning on the 20th of December. There's no real beginning or no real end. The lights are just sort of constantly parading these designs as they arrive from the internet. And thanks to Mexican pollution, we got really good visibility of the searchlights. It could be seen from a 15-kilometer radius, so that was awesome. And the idea is that this project would not exist without participation. My projects are about taking over those platforms, about sort of delegating the control over to the public. And it's kind of a humbling sort of experience, because if no one participates, then those searchlights just turn off and they don't exist. And here's another scene, like this is on the 3rd of January, like at 8 p.m. So people are just sort of walking around having their normal, you know, affairs. And, you know, the searchlights are basically changing all of the skyline in the city center. And the idea is not to have like a privileged sort of vantage point to be able to see the show, but in fact that it's something that's more decentered. And the idea, again, is to sort of take something from the internet, which is such an individual sort of interface, something that we do sort of by ourselves at home or at work or whatnot, and then take it into an urban sort of scale and sort of take over these technologies of amplification and transform the city itself. And what would happen is, you see how the lights stop for a second. What we would do with each design is we would automatically photograph it and make a web page for each and every participant. So you'd get an email back saying, you know, your design is ready, check this web page. And it would have your name and your dedication and photos on the left of the actual virtual design that you made, and on the right, the photos from the very same vantage point, because it was very important at the time, this was still PRI in power, to send the message in Mexico after 80 years of voting and nothing happening, that participation was a vehicle for transformation and that you really did take over that space, and in a way it was some kind of souvenir. Now, on the top right, you'll see that there's this comments, and they're completely uncensored. At the time, it was the Zapatista rebellion was quite active in Mexico, so it was exciting that that this opportunity allowed us to have that kind of thing. So we got a lot of Zapatista slogans and whatnot, but we also got like marriage proposals. We got dedications to Margarita, who's at the hospital. Hope you get better. Football scores. I mean, the whole works. And the idea of the project itself is that this is the memory of the project itself, is that people's takeover of the platform is what remains in the end.
Claro que sí, está bonita.
Un espectáculo muy, muy bonito, ¿no? Padrísimas.
Son muy potentes.
Hermosas. Me dijo mi mamá que esas luces son las puede manejar uno que tenga qué?
Internet.
Ah, sí, vamos a verlas.
No, más que nada son sistemas computarizados manejados de luces, pero no interviene nada de internet.
Sí,
son sistemas.
Sí, sí interviene.
¿Esto
porque
sí es internet?
Sí. De cada parte de la República hicieron sus diseños para que aquí juntaran las luces y se vieran.
Revista
en 5 minutos los diseños y pasan el nombre y la dirección del chavo que los hizo.
Y ahora que venimos al Zócalo, vemos las luces y ahora decimos, ahora estamos en un Hollywood, pero mexicano.
Sí, muy bonito. Que es una obra de arte.
Uno mismo manda su diseño.
El mejor es el que hace así el techo.
Me preguntaba que si tenían algún significado cruzados y todo eso, por la cuestión de las constelaciones.
De hecho, nos parece un...
So over the period of 2 weeks that this project was live, in fact, through the media and also through word of mouth, people would find out that that movement wasn't just pre-programmed, it wasn't just a canned show, but it was, in fact, people sending stuff over the internet. We got 800,000 participants over 2 weeks from 89 countries. 70% of the traffic came from Mexico itself. And, you know, in 1999, only 1% of the population had access to the internet in Mexico, and, of course, that was just the elite. We tried to put some terminals so that people locally could be able to access and make their own design. The project has toured. We've shown it in different kinds of contexts. This is in Lyon in France at the Place Bellecour. And the video camera is better, so you see the light beams, you know, a little bit more clearly. And what I'm very interested in, too, at the level of the urban space, is that people just sort of promenade under the canopy of lights. In this case, like, for instance, we see the actual terminals that people could actually make designs with as well. The second old project I'm going to show is a large shadow play, which was originally inspired by an engraving by Samuel von Hoogstraten called The Shadow Dance, which showed the sort of game of representation that Rembrandt and Hoogstraten and all the sort of Dutch masters were working on. And one of the things that fascinated me is this idea of the monstrous, the large shadows where demonic and the small ones are angelic and pure. So the relationship between scale and presence was something that I was wanting to explore. And the commission was originally for Rotterdam, for the Schouwburg Plain in Rotterdam. And it basically is 1,200 square meters of interactive projections. It's the photography that is being projected onto the building is 60 foot high. And then there's very, very powerful projectors that are washing out the portraits in such a way that as you walk across the path of the bottom projectors, your shadows cast onto the wall, and then you can sort of grow your shadow to embody or to take over the representation of these portraits. The portraits are over 1,000 portraits taken in the cities where the project is shown, and you know, as you walk close to or far away from the facade, your shadow grows from 6 feet all the way to 60 feet, in this particular project, participation is not optional. Like basically, as you cross by, your shadow is there, and people would sort of engage in these kinds of ad hoc narratives as they take over representations. And contrary to most of my own work and some of my colleagues' works in new media, the problem is that, you know, oftentimes to work with electronic art, you need to have some instructions and press here and pull here and whatnot. With the shadow, it was really refreshing because everybody has a very sophisticated sort of relationship to what it is that they can do with their shadow. Most cultures have like a sophisticated shadow puppetry or theater tradition. And so that kind of came out. It was very, you know, very performative as a piece. And this project was up for 3 weeks, you know, from dusk till midnight every night. And we would get like very, very different kinds of participation. We'd get on Tuesdays was methadone night at a nearby church, so you'd get all the heroin addicts. You'd get like, you know, the dancers and old people just sort of hitting young people, and a guy in a wheelchair crushing everybody under his wheels, deriving a lot of pleasure. And technologically, the project worked with a surveillance system. It's like a camera that observed where the shadows were. And this is a very sort of early version of this interface. And whenever a shadow and a portrait met, there was a small sound, feedback sound in the space, kind of like a tick, just to let you know that you had just uncovered that portrait. But more importantly, the moment that all of the portraits in a given scene were revealed, automatically the system would black out and trigger a new set of portraits, in a way frustrating representation, because the project's not about the portraits, it's about becoming the portraits. And so you see that in this particular scene where people kind of collaborate, they basically embody all of them, and then the computer shuts down and it cues a new image. So these technologies that typically get used for, you know, sort of Coca-Cola ads or for Olympics or for some kind of sort of corporate takeover of public space are being misused, if you will, to try and create platforms for self-representation. I'm very interested in the disconnect between the citizenry and their built environment. Churchill's once said, "We make buildings and buildings make us," but the contemporary situation suggests that that's no longer true, that in fact a building made in New York or Mexico City or Madrid, they're very similar, because it's not about representing your citizenry, but rather globalization, you know, how best or how to optimize the construction of a building with the least amount of money, and therefore, you know, building typologies emerge that are very, very similar. So faced with that, I believe that art has a function to stir things up a little bit, to create these temporary platforms for this eccentric special effects. And oftentimes I've been asked, you know, well, you know, this is not art, this is special effects. That's fine with me. In the end, I see it very close or a little bit closer to performing arts of visual arts. And and it's with the previous projects or with all my projects, if no one's participating, then you see nothing. You just basically see a wide illuminated building, and that's about it. Some people, let's see. She abused her boyfriend for a couple of hours. And we literally have like 60 hours of video of just what people came up with. I just pulled out like 4 or 5 minutes to show you, but it's quite incredible. So that's Body Movies. This project has also toured. I have a statement, which is that instead of making site-specific work, I make relationship-specific work, which is to say that as these pieces get performed in different contexts, you get a chance to sort of understand a little bit of the sort of local performance. You know, there's certain stereotypes get broken as you see the project being taken in different cities. You know, as a Latino, you know, my stereotype is the Latinos, we like to touch each other very much. But when this was shown in Lisbon, in Portugal, everyone was like, okay, I'm not going to touch your shadow, and you're over there, and I'm clean, and whatever. Whereas when we showed it in England, I did this at the Liverpool Biennial. I'd never worked in England, and my stereotype of British people is class and stiff upper lip and propriety and whatever, and basically people were taking off their clothes and just having this ad hoc orgies, to which I thought, you know, the British are really entitled in public space. They feel quite free to just take off their clothes. But that was nice. To break those stereotypes is an exciting sort of discovery from this kind of experimental approach to large-scale interventions. So now three projects that I just did recently. Recently with my friends Martin Friedman and John Hanhart and Debbie Landau, a project was commissioned for Madison Square Park. And what it was is a variation on a number of projects that I'm doing now with the heartbeat, with sort of the heart rate measured of the public members, and then visualized usually through light in an array of spotlights. So what this project was over, I think it was like 5 or 6 weeks, we had 200 theatrical spotlights placed in the perimeter of the central oval lawn of the park, and we had an interface that allowed people to register their heartbeat, not unlike what you might find at a gym. And then those heartbeats would get converted into light pulses in the park. So what would happen is, as you approach the interface, you would hold on, and then gradually your heart would start taking over all of the lights until all 150,000 watts of light was sort of amplifying your electrical activity in your heart. And then when you would release the sensor, all the lights would go off, and your heartbeat would go to the very first spotlight, pushing all the previous recordings one position down. And so at any given time, as you walked into the park, you'd be sort of surrounded by the 200 heart readings of the past 200 participants. And it's a little bit of a memento mori, because as the 201st person after you comes in, you disappear from the park. It's a project that is inspired by a Mexican film called Macario, which is like the Mexican Matrix. It's kind of this guy is hallucinating. It's a hunger-induced hallucination where he sees everybody who's alive represented by this little flickering candle. So it's a project that is low-key. It was not spectacular from the point of view of a monument or something like this. It was more like an environment. And the idea, again, was for people to take over that space and walk around and sort of be surrounded by this kind of, you know, very systemic, very repetitive sort of sequences of light. I compare it a little bit to Conlon Nancarrow or Steve Reich or Glenn Branca, this repetitive sort of sequences that then create this sort of larger tableau. So that project was in Madison Square Park last fall, and it was cool because most of the sort of other artists who participate in the Madison Square Park sort of series are people like Sol LeWitt or Marc de Suvero, or like physical objects, and the idea that light can constitute a viable sculpture I find really satisfying. So that's one. And I say often that my work is as big as my insecurities, but I've been going to therapy for a long time, so now I'm also doing smaller things. This is a series. There's a series of shadow boxes, I call them. They're basically reactive displays which have a built-in sort of surveillance system. And let me put the sound of this. And when you stand in front of it, it casts your shadow inside of the display, and things happen. So there's different kinds of shadow boxes. The one that I'm showing you today is called Reporters with Borders. What we did is we hired some guys to watch TV for our 3 weeks, and we took 1,600 reporters, 800 from Mexican TV and 800 from American TV. And what we do is we show them on the display classified according to gender, race, and geography, country. So right now what you're seeing is everybody on the right is female and everybody on the left is male. And then after 5 minutes, what we would do is we would reclassify the database of 1,600 and show them, for instance, divided by race or country. So you'd have Mexicans on the left and Americans on the right. And as you walk from left to right, you can actually tune in and listen to the news being told, say, only by women or only by men or whatnot. And it's kind of like a fun project to sort of massively compare, hundreds of reporters at the same time. Then I couldn't help myself, and I made a big version of it. So this is at Haunch of Venison Gallery in London. It's actually 11 meters wide, and you're seeing now lighter and darker people. And this is female and male. We actually got CNN covered this project, and one of the CNN reporters was there, and she was misclassified. It was really embarrassing. She was in the darker side, and she says, "Oh, I'm Anglo-Saxon, and I'm from Ottawa." And I'm like, "Okay, look, sorry, I'll fix that," and I did. Okay, the last project I want to show you today, and the reason I'm showing these projects is because to me the important thing about a lot of the work that I care about is work in which there's a complicity with the spectator, not necessarily an interactivity, but a complicity, like an idea that the work needs to be completed by being performed or viewed or exposed. This is a project that was commissioned by the university in Mexico City. As you may know, in 40 years ago exactly, the Mexican government massacred somewhere between 100 and 300 students in the Tlatelolco Plaza. And this has been taboo for a long time. Now Echeverria, who's one of the people responsible, is in house arrest. You know that thing we do in Latin America where, oh, he's too old to go to jail. Let's keep him with his 600 thread count Egyptian cotton sheets at his home. But that's what we're doing, and at least people are talking about it. They have now a beautiful archive in a cultural center right in Tlatelolco. But they commissioned me to set up a memorial, if you will, and all the artists that I admire, people like Hans Hakes or Johann Gertz or Rachel Whiteread, really come through in projects that have this kind of very dark, ominous representation. And so I was very excited to do this project. My proposal was a megaphone not unlike the one that you might find at the student movement of 68, placed exactly in the same plaza where the massacre took place. And you would grab onto the megaphone and speak into it, and your voice would come out amplified on the other end. But at the same time, your voice was converted into light flashes with a very, very powerful 10,000-watt searchlight beam, which would hit the top of the old Ministry of External Affairs, right exactly at the office of the minister. So as you spoke, your light would, your voice would be converted into light. If you were quiet, it was off. As you spoke, it would blink. And then once it hit the top of the building, it would be sent to three sort of sides of Mexico City, toward the north, toward the Zocalo Square, and then toward the Monument to the Revolution, blinking your message through into the city. And as you were in anywhere in your work or your home or a school, you could actually tune into FM 96.1, Radio University, and listen live to what the light was saying. So the idea that there was this kind of uncensored, unmoderated platform for, you know, sort of just visualizing the communication, but also to have the agency of disintermediating the media, which in fact in Mexico, as you know, is completely complicit. For instance, with the massacre, you know, Televisa, you know, the one of the main sort of media companies reported that one student had died. And it was very funny because they actually did not cover this project, which got me really mad because I thought this was the best project I've ever made. Not so much because of the project, but because of the response. What we got is everything from survivors of the massacre coming up. We had a man, my name is Rodrigo, whatever. I'm here to say that I'm the son of one of the soldiers that committed the massacre. And I'm here to say that this ends here. I'm a new generation. I've lived with this guilt all my life. And it was just like, we were all like, oh my God, that's so heavy. So another guy came up and said, I'm here. I'm a fireman. I've been in the fire force for 25 years. And I'm here to denounce that routinely the Mexican government asks firemen to put dye, to put a coloring in our water tanks. So when we spray protesters, they're easy to identify. And I am here to defend and save people, not to be part of the oppressive apparatus. We're all like, holy shit. It was just so intense. It was so necessary. Of course, we also got marriage proposals and shout-outs and you know, all sorts of crazy stuff. But the idea of making a platform that would sort of cut through that worked quite well. It was inspired, in fact, by an estudiantista poem from the Mexican futurists called Altavoz, from Miguel de Icaza. So those are the projects that I have, and then I guess in the talk we can relate it to Facebook or internet or things like that. Oh, actually, there's a little. Do I have time? It's only a couple minutes. So this is just some footage from what happened in '68. Basically, people were corralled onto the plaza, and oh, and I should mention, when no one was participating, the lights on the top of the building were playing back archival sounds of actual people who got murdered, of the student movement, of sound, you know, sort of music from 1968. So in a way, what we were trying to do is mix the memory of 68 with contemporary sort of people just taking the microphone and speaking. Okay. So this is one of the survivors. Okay. Thank you.
Please.
Here?
No, why don't you sit there?
Okay.
I'll sit on the edge. So first of all, Corey and Rafael, thank you so much. I won't say that I understand entirely how you get the various effects that you managed to pull off, but maybe we can get into that. But really appreciate the time you've taken to share your work with us. Let me start with something that must be on everybody's mind, that's the inauguration today. What an amazing day it was. Do you guys watch it?
Yes. It was awesome.
I totally did, yeah. Too much. Like, I watched everything.
Did you watch it on TV, on the internet? How did you absorb it?
I watched it at Junior's Diner in the Fulton Mall. Because I live right by there. And that it was great. Everyone was screaming. It's just fantastic, you know?
Yeah, I was at my hotel just flipping through channels, see how Fox News covered it and so on. It was really great.
But we were saying earlier that apparently the internet slowed down. That was that's what we heard that right at that time, which I would believe. So.
Yeah. And everybody with their cell phones were like trying to send pictures at the in D.C. and it just sort of brought the whole network to its knees, which is nice.
Which kind of leads us into some of your own...
Yeah, which we should all get used to because it's going to go down one day. Sorry.
So I was really. I mean, some of us might actually be relieved.
Oh, I know, right? It would be great.
It's like just like for a moment.
Oh, I know.
Slow down. But Corey, you were saying that you spend the day surfing the internet.
Oh, I have. Yeah, lately
that's what you do.
I like to think it's a research, right? You know. It's been a real problem with me lately. I mean, I always liked the internet, you know. But now just everything is on the internet. And YouTube is just a real problem zone because every little tiny interest that you've ever had, you could, you know, I mean, you could just, you know, like, I could type in some band that I kind of knew about and then see 50,000 videos of them playing. And, like, I don't know. It's just, like, everything that I've always wanted to see that was prohibited because of, one-way cable. You know, cable is a one-way thing, and now that it's two ways, it's just like being in a fantasy land or some kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't know what, you know, I don't know how I'm going to stop, or I don't know what's going to come of it. You know, it's terrible. My productivity has gone down. I can't concentrate. As you saw in my talk, I can't concentrate. I can't, like, really put linear thoughts together anymore. You know, anyway.
But you know, isn't that one of the things that's liberating about the internet is that it kind of abolishes linearity, that suddenly, you know, that time-space continuum dissolves?
Whoa, that's a heavy question. Do you want to take that one?
Sure. Let's see. No, I do. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is it especially when it comes to art, a lot of people, more than ever in the history of the world, are calling themselves artists. And, you know, I can see both why that's really good and it's also extremely tedious. But I think that what happens is the presentation, the production of work, and your capability to actually put it out there has increased exponentially. And so oftentimes there are certain kinds of more niche or more marginal sort of creators who can then present the work at a large scale, and I think that that's quite significant. So as much as I would like to be cynical about the fact that the internet is not the solution to the global village or whatever, I mean, I do think that there are some elements about it that are extremely healthy and extremely horizontal and democratizing, though it sounds kind of trash. But I do think that more people are producing art now and being able to find ways to distribute it and getting out there through the internet, for instance.
I mean, well, I was really struck by something both of you said, but that got me back to this point of, you know, this is real, this is virtual. Mm-hmm. I mean, hasn't that distinction disappeared now? I mean, does it really matter whether it's on the internet or whether it's taking place in some other space? It's in both instances, hasn't it become real? Or isn't it in both instances virtual? I mean, or is there still a virtual space that's just different? Like you go through that door, it's a different mm-hmm. kind of experience.
Should I take that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
That's a really great thing. I think, as far as my experience is concerned with that, there isn't a difference anymore. I mean, I know a lot. Like that pizza party thing, I think more people have seen that than anything I've ever done, you know? And it's, for me, the only time that the virtual and real divide comes up in real life is when I work in a real traditional art context, you know what I mean? So, because I think the... in the art context, I think there still is a difference between real space and virtual, you know, because it's difficult for me sometimes because I have two sets of fans, really. A lot of people know the things I do online and have never seen anything I've done or even know anything about art context and the other way around. So I think it will eventually dissolve, but I don't think we're exactly there yet. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
You seem to blur the two, right? You get a kind of event happening in the Zocalo, mm-hmm. and at the same time, you're asking for participation really only via the internet. You can be an observer in the space, but you can't really be a participant.
That's true, which is actually a problem with that piece in particular. And I have a problem with that. I've tried to resolve that problem in other projects by producing it more local agencies that will allow, like even the project when you have the grip, you know, you have this relationship to the piece right away. But yeah, like, I mean, for me, I mean, I studied in Canada where they're all about, like, McLuhan, technology is a second skin. The idea that we can separate ourselves from technology is impossible. That, you know, we cannot sort of distance ourselves from a media culture and so on. So there's definitely that. And then from the other side, from my Mexican side, there is, like, a very substantial sort of understanding of technological development in Mexico, you know, that is linked to you know, everything from, you know, sort of philosophy to social movements and so on. I'm thinking of not just the futurists, the estudiantistas, but I'm thinking about the postulation of the theory of cybernetics, which was in Mexico, the first color TV, which was in Mexico, the first virtual reality helmet, which was in Mexico. I'm making like a... I'm feeling guilty that I said I wanted to be American, so now I'm like backpedaling, trying to say how great it is to be Mexican. But basically that technology is not a tool, that is not something that it's out there, but that it forms part of us, that in a way it's a language that it's inescapable, that is the language of globalization. So the sooner we come to terms with the idea that we're, you know, inseparable from it, the less we will be like Pol Pot.
You had me at the virtual helmet.
1964, Morton Heilig, Cuernavaca.
Wow.
Yeah.
Super.
Yeah, yeah. And it had...
You gotta find out
I've always wanted to do, yeah, like a talk with the virtual helmet. I'm just like wandering into walls and it's, you know. Sorry.
I always have this, and maybe it's utterly misplaced sense when I look at your web-based work, that it's almost nostalgic.
Yeah, I mean, I get some of it... is, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why you have that sense, because I think about it a lot. Because technology time is very, very fast, you know what I mean? So we were looking at some of those early design, web designs, and that everyone, I think, would be nostalgic for. But, I mean, that's only like 7 or 8 years ago, you know what I mean? So I think what happens, and it's a weird thing, because I could reference something 8 years ago, and then, you know, I could do a silk screen, which is technology from 40 or 50 years ago, and people will reference technology as nostalgia and the silk screen as being like room temperature water. And so I think it is because technology is so fast that and there is a perception if you're not always using the thing that is very current, it is nostalgic. And I think that is something that is pretty kind of interesting, and I think that's just the way it is with technology. You know, I mean, if I have last year's iPhone... Or if you see an old iPod, people laugh now, you know? So it's an interesting phenomenon. I kind of like that, you know? So
it is also, it reminds me of an anecdote with this, Jesusa Rodriguez is this Mexican theater director. She told me, I was doing technological theater at the time, and she summoned me and said, Rafael, how do you dare put something as rich and sophisticated as theater with something as primitive like technology, the idea that what we're that there are certain first steps, you know, that we're sort of grasping, you know, the limits and the meta narratives of what it is that these technologies mean, you know, to society or to culture or whatever is very evident. I think that the electronic art is still in its infancy to an extent, and it's already sort of you know, beginning to develop its own languages, but it'll take a while.
I've actually seen almost every one of the works that you showed, and I'd never, some of them, you know, clearly there's a kind of overt political dimension to it, but it seems, maybe it was just a reading from tonight, and the politics of the moment are present, but there's such a strong political edge to your work. That is that a kind of intentional dimension of what you call complicity of the spectator to take even the sort of casual passerby and almost use technology to subvert them into a larger engagement?
I would agree that they're all political, but not political as in capital P. It's more like this, I talk about this micropolitics. Just I'm very interested in the political as it relates to the day-to-day, you know, just somebody who was passing by one of these pieces and then all of a sudden found themselves in the microphone, and they're not saying something particularly, you know, sort of verbose or strong. They're just telling you what happened in their day. So these sort of chance encounters between an old lady and a punk, you know, in the street, and the narrative that they make, I think that's political, and that's the kind of political that I'm interested in, is the politics of relations of
ourselves in public space, as opposed to the more panfletario, the more sort of big politics. I don't know how you say it. Do you say pamphlet? Do you say pamphlet? But pamphleteering or something like that, but more like you set up a platform, and then once it's there, you just sit back and you watch what happens, you know? And of course, I showed you only stuff that worked. There's been many projects that have completely failed.
Yeah, I think this particular type of work has a high failure rate. I definitely can attest to that. Can I ask him a question?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Do you think that what's happening with online social networks, are they encouraging the type of relationships that you were just talking about, these kind of random things that would never happen? Or do you think that they discourage that type of discourse?
I actually just joined Facebook, and I'm, you know, sort of quite overwhelmed with, you know, all the different people mm-hmm. who are my friends, mm-hmm. Apparently. And I'm just sort of, like, trying to figure out what is going on. I know definitely that through the net I can be in touch with a network of people that otherwise I would have never mm-hmm. been in touch with. So I do email, and as I look at that, I think that relationships can be refreshed and maintained over mm-hmm. great distances, and that's all good. But I am confused about Facebook, very confused, you know, because it's almost as though we could, you know, it's very incestuous, and then you just sort of live in that world, and it's kind of problematic. But I don't know what to do.
You have to ask younger people.
Right.
You have to say, is it cool to poke somebody back? And they will say, don't ever poke anybody back. Or that's how I ask.
And do you want to just explain for those?
Okay, Facebook, please. There's a thing called poke, which actually was really brilliant. It's like the lowest level of communication you do on Facebook. So you don't have to say anything. You don't have to actually communicate anything. You just poke somebody. And when somebody pokes you, you can either choose to poke them back. But that's one of the most brilliant things about Facebook, is because it's like, what are people really doing online? I think that's what's nice about online communication. And Twitter is a part of this too. It's like, let's take communication down to just the dredges, because it's really what people want, which is fine with me. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anyway, I don't know.
But I like
sense.
The poke. So it's kind of like just going like this to somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, it's like, hey, what's happening?
But I think when it comes to the artistic program, I've been for a long time on a sort of mission to talk against communication in art. I think that this idea of, we'll communicate better. It's like there's nothing wrong with communication. We don't need all of these things to communicate better. From the point of view of art, I think that art grows in the spaces of ambiguity and silence and interception and misunderstanding. That's really where the exciting part is. So sometimes I think that any artwork that actually slows down communication, that perverts it, is actually the one that has the merit, as opposed to the one that is going to put you in touch with you know, all these other people. You don't want that. What you want is to reflect, in my opinion, to reflect about, well, what is, you know, this environment doing to my life or to my politics or to the economy or whatever. So slowing down and perversion are two ways to improve. I mean, not to improve, but to be artistic about this kind of electronic media.
Well, that kind of leads right into a lot of your work, which it strikes me, Corey, is about subversion. It's about taking something that's supposed to do this.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know how you do it, but just altering,
like,
the code.
Yeah, making it like not work, or, yeah, confusing people with it. Yeah, misusing it. Or using it like so correctly that people are just like, why would you even, you know what I mean? Like, if you take something stupid enough and use it correctly, it has the same purpose as taking something interesting and misusing it, you know? I don't know why I've always liked to do that, but it's just, I like things that don't work. I like situations where people are, they sit down and they just have, like, is this broken? You know what I mean? Like, I like that. Because usually, I think with media art, that happens anyway a lot. And so why not just start it off broken sometimes, you know? So, I mean, all these ideas are all bundled up in it, you know, and I can't get over it. And I think it's something that will always be with me, you know?
It's a very satisfying moment of breakdown when you have, like, somebody like going to give a big teleconference and you're waiting for the connection, and people are like all nervous because there's some guy in the lab coat trying to figure it out, and after 3 minutes of everybody being quiet, they start laughing.
Yeah,
and
it's
there's
like
this
a
moment
snow
of
day.
Yeah, of this human sort of complicity.
But there's a famous story that Namjoon Pike's the reason that he started doing his sculptures with TVs is because he would do gallery shows and he'd have one TV and it would break, and he would go to the gallery and he would just put a new TV on top of the first TV. And that was how, I mean, I don't, it's an urban legend, but I would believe it, because I mean, back when I was doing, I'm sure you did too, using CRT televisions, I mean, those things would kick out right in the middle of a show, you know? And so, anyway, but yeah.
So are you in front of or behind technology?
I don't know. Maybe
beside
both. Yeah, both. Somebody came to my last show and they just looked to me and they saw the show and they're like, "Do you hate technology?" And I was like, "Yeah, kind of. Although I'm a computer programmer and I spend all day on my computer." So I think both. I like new technologies. I like, my obsession right now is using new technologies as intended. You know what I mean? I think that's really, really heroic. Yeah, like at this point, I've like kind of spun around so many times that I think that's like my new position. I'm like, I'm going to use Photoshop exactly as it was designed, you know, and create this monstrosity, you know. And then at the same time, older technology, because it is slightly already subversive to use it. Just, yeah, I guess both. But you know, there's real no, I waver.
So when you... Both of you are so adept, adroit at actually the algorithms that make these things look the way they do. Do you, when you look at Photoshop or software that none of us actually understand but we all use, do you go underneath? Do you actually understand why it's doing what it does? Can you get right down to the code that is driving this? Or do you have to... Does it take a long... Do you even care?
You want to...
Well, in my case, I'm a programmer, but a very bad one. So I actually work with people who are really good. So I work in teams. So I would not claim to be able to get behind the scenes in that way, though I know enough to be able to, you know, not be a fraud. But when I'm working with a project, with a program that is existing, if it does what I need it to do, then I don't, you know, I'm not necessarily seeking out to deconstruct it or anything like that. I think that as you work with one of those softwares, what you do need to realize is that those tools are biased, that they have a provenance, that they come from a very specific desire to do something. In the case of Photoshop, you know, this idea of being able to palletize everything and to be able to perform operations on it, and that those biases that are inherent in software are like a dialogue. You're speaking to a very specific kind of collaborator, and you're having a dialogue or a participate or collaboration, if you will, with those people who imbued that technology with those, you know, characteristics. So long as you're not pretending that what you're doing is neutral or individual, then I think that it's always going to be like a dialogue with whoever's developed the actual tool, even if you don't go under the hood.
I'd go with that. Sounds good.
Good. Let's drink.
I want to get back to this issue of participation, because you both use it in very different ways. I mean, you create these very public spectacles. Spectacle is the right word. Public events that allow thousands of people to congregate and engage in these new relationships. And a lot of your work, Corey, of course, takes place in galleries, but your internet-based work creates a very different kind of public. And I wonder how you think of your public. I mean, does it get fine-grained and personal? Is it some abstract notion? When you're making a work, are you imagining who would be using it?
I think with the internet I have a definite... I mean, I'm just more comfortable on the internet. So when I make something for the internet, I know exactly who the public is. So for, you know, that Domino's pizza thing, I knew it was going to be computer nerds. I knew what websites they hung out on. You know, I know those people. So each internet project is, I know exactly what the audience will be.
But then you're surprised that other people actually from other...
Yeah, you always will be surprised.
Who ends up seeing the piece.
Yeah, who ends up, yeah, I mean... And some pieces travel very, very, very far. That Kurt Cobain thing traveled really far. I mean, that was like a, you know, that's why I got took down, because everyone in the, someone at Google probably, you know, finally saw it. But yes, because I understand who's on the internet And the internet is growing so much now, it's getting even more exciting because it's like TV now. You know, I mean, you really have a real, just general public. For the art context stuff, I have no idea who comes and sees art stuff. I mean, that stuff still got me a little bit in the dark, you know.
Raphael, do you have a sense of who your public is?
Yeah, it depends on the piece. I mean, I do, what I showed here today is mostly public space thing, which is really, for me, refreshing because you actually have no control of who is your public, and that's, for me, really great. If the piece is out of control, then I think it's successful, out of my control. Then sometimes I do things for museums or galleries, and you know I'm sort of more knowledgeable about who might show up. But yeah, the question of who is the public is crucial because in the end, that's the artwork. Mm-hmm. Whatever they come up with is what people will see in the end. So it really matters as a question. But I don't have any answers yet.
Oh, can I ask one question? Has there ever been an artwork you did in public, like one that, and then someone wanted to put it in a gallery, and you were just like, no, that ain't going to work?
Not so much. I do sell out quite a bit. It's true. But what I have done is I've made, like, for instance, a shadow play. I got approached by a car company to do that in their car trade fair or whatever. And I said, sure, you know, I have no problem working with corporations. But they said, well, every 5 minutes, one of our cars will go by and a guy will show up. And then I just said, no, actually, you know, we got to sort of separate the two functions.
But it's pretty wide open. You don't, there's no, okay, yeah, that's cool.
So the only thing that I put a limit on is ensuring that there's no, a friend of mine calls it logo creep, you know, that all of a sudden the artwork, especially when you're working in North America, if a company gives you a lot of money, they want to make it into a Grand Prix, you know, like with their name everywhere and so on. And it's difficult to negotiate. No, you actually have to sort of respect the trust that you sort of establish in public space. Mm-hmm. But with galleries, no. If a gallery invites me, I'm there.
You said that they're failures too.
Yeah.
Can you share a few of the ones that...
Sure. Probably the biggest one is the shadow play that you saw, the big one with body movies. 4 years before, I had done a project called Reposition Fear, which was my very first big shadow play. And it was a commission to transform this military arsenal in Graz in Austria. And I thought, okay, great, you know, I'm going to make this project about, you know, how fears have transformed, and I'm going to use the shadow because it's going to be this more now expressionistic expression of otherness and whatever. And I had this whole sort of theory, and then the moment we put it on, immediately people showed up, and then they started, like, playing and doing just like nobody ever thought about fear or anything like that. It was just all, like, a really carnivalesque kind of fun thing, and it was great. It was a really great mistake, you know, because it was completely backfired. Yeah. So that's an example.
Oh, here we go with this. Oh, man. Well, since my artwork doesn't... Well, I could answer this in two different ways. One is for a while, I was making artwork that was supposed to engage... I was studying meme culture and how to make things spread rapidly on the internet. So I was making artwork that was supposed to draw a public, you know. And if it didn't draw a public, you knew it was a failure. And so one thing I did, I think, was carryrocks.net, like a viral John Kerry marketing ad for the 2004 election. And we put it up, and it was me, like, in a John Kerry mask, playing heavy metal guitar. And we thought it was going to be on every blog, and it, like, was, like, 10 people a day. It was just a tough... So that is a good, you know... And then, you know, the stuff that doesn't require a public, I mean, then a failure is just a bad artwork. I mean, and I, like, one out of every... Well, 9 out of 10, maybe, you know, I mean, just go to any of my shows, you know? I mean, you know, you always have to try stuff. And I think like there was a big Photoshop thing in my last show, I think was really nice, but that was, I think, maybe the 6th or 7th one I tried, and the ones before that just didn't work, you know? So I'll take stuff back and then keep trying, and then eventually something will stick, you know?
To come back a little bit to this issue of open sourcing. Mm-hmm. Is open source a good idea, an irrelevant idea, just is? How, you know, like, it's a kind of fascinating thing, right? Because it dissolves this notion of proprietary mm-hmm. information, proprietary technology. Where does that lead, do you think?
Do you want me to start that one?
Yeah.
Where does that lead? Well, it leads to some great things already. I mean, Linux and Ubuntu, and for art, where does it lead? Art, it gets into a whole bunch of interesting problems, because if you know, it dissolves the object, it dissolves the definitive version. I have an artwork I made that is the clouds from Mario Brothers, and I put the code for that online, and somebody emailed me last year, and they're like, Corey, there's a mistake here. One of the pixels is wrong. I mean, so what do I do now? Do you know what I mean? Like, that there was supposed to be a version of that, but now I know that there's a mistake. And so I think it's totally fascinating, but it obviously gets into weird territory. And so if you're into, like, total chaos, then it's a wonderful thing for art. You know?
It's good to know there are people out there that are looking so closely at your work that they can figure out there's a pixel that's wrong.
I know. He combed through every pixel and just emailed me, hey, man, love the project, but...
Have people, okay, so that's an observation that you got a pixel wrong. Mm-hmm. Have people sort of taken your work and started to decode it and restructure it? What's happened?
Well, for the projects that I have put the code online, I mean, for that cloud one, someone made one without the clouds. Someone made the clouds go backwards. Somebody put it on a Game Boy. You know, I mean, people just made all these different versions, and I think that is awesome. And with the pizza thing, like I mentioned, apparently it works for Papa John's now. It's in different programming languages. And that's pretty amazing, I think. I mean, that to me is really, really, really exciting, you know.
And I think another sort of element that's interesting about open source, especially when, for the museum, if you take the position that a lot of electronic art is, in fact, conceptual art, is really Solowitz, the art of instructions. So you have these instructions, but you put them on paper. It sort of liberates you from this object-based thing. So, for example, you guys here have a piece of mine, which is the software that generates 55 billion questions. And the question is, well, what will happen when that computer dies? And the answer is, that computer is not the artwork. The artwork is this code, which is open to you to, sort of migrate. Replicate it, migrate it to sort of emulate it or sort of recompile it for future platforms. So in that sense, it's kind of interesting, because people are going like, well, new media is difficult to conserve. It's like, well, no, it's not only not difficult to conserve, it gets better over time, because, people can add to this code, in a way. So it's an interesting sort of position, because it liberates you from the fetish of the necrophiliac object.
It's actually really interesting. Do you feel the same way about your work?
Definitely. I think the ones that I have put online, I often think about preservation and not necessarily museum-based, but I think... for example, once my laptop got stolen and I lost all these projects, and then I went surfing around the internet and the projects had dispersed. And so I found them back on all these weird people's sites, and I just downloaded them again. That's something that's a similar kind of thing, so that's how that situation interests me, And if other people are updating it or if they're dispersed, I think no new media, no sweat, man.
Let's turn to all of you, and if you have a question, I think there are microphones on either side of the aisles, but raise your hand and please join in. It's a quiet crowd tonight. Yes, please. Go ahead.
I really enjoyed your talks, so thanks. I was curious about the notion of open source as kind of a collaborative effort, and whether you guys, if you could talk about a little bit of your collaborations and how the idea of open source might relate to that.
So in my case, I work with a team of people. Oftentimes that team grows, and it really depends on the project. Oftentimes, like all of the libraries to do computer vision system, the surveillance tracking, is all OpenCV. It's like a open source project. And we sort of add to it and then release that, you know, to sort of add to this open source project, which we think is really cool. But we benefit from it too. So oftentimes what we have is a very, our model of credits, if you want, is very performing arts. So there's a director, but then there is a composer or actors or photographers or linguists or programmers or so on. And so what is important is to give credit to people who participate in that, because as you may know, most people who are working in open source aren't really doing it to get financial gain specifically from that, but by, you know, collaborating, improving the sort of ecosystem of tools that it's out there. So I find it important, and this just happened in my website, every project has the credits of who, you know, sort of input it into the project. And it's just one way to sort of be transparent about the fact that this is not really something I did. It's a team of people that collaborated to make it happen.
Corey?
I don't know. I guess usually I sometimes I'll work with one person sometimes. I don't know. Sometimes I just will put up my, I don't really participate in, I don't collaborate with large groups of people online or anything. Usually I have like a very particular vision that if I need some help, I'll find somebody and we'll make the project, and then eventually we'll just put it online and we'll say, this is our version. And then at that point we don't, it's just, I'm done, you know? So people can do whatever they want with it, but I don't, you know, I'm not a big participator, you know what I mean? Like, I do something and then it's over. I'm pretty unactive at that point, you know.
Other questions?
Both of the artists talked about the fact that the technology is a tool, but it's not. You talked, Rafa, about code, the work that MoMA owns. It's the questions, it's the code, it's not the computer, the screen that it's shown on that's important. But isn't there a whole body of work for both of you that the technology at the moment that you created it is important? The screens may change in their brightness. The light bulbs may no longer be manufactured. Isn't there some element? When Corey was showing the web designs from 10 years ago versus now and how they've changed, isn't there a moment when you want to be able to look at it the way it was created, with the technology it was created, that's an important part of the work? Or is it always migratory towards brighter picture, better X and Y?
Should I start with that one?
Yeah.
Some of the things I made are very specific, especially some of the things I didn't show, but some of the gallery-based work are violently specific towards. Well, I have a whole series where if I do a show in, you know, Sweden or something, I'll have the gallery buy a local plasma monitor, and then I'll just take my name and the information about the piece and put it on the plasma, and eventually it'll burn in. It'll, because plasmas have this flaw in them. And so, yeah, that's an example of a piece which is about that plasma monitor. And when that plasma monitor doesn't work anymore, it can no longer exist. So my answer to the question is, no, it's not always about migration, you know. Sometimes, or at least in my case, I'll make things very specific. But again, if they're very specific, they're very specific about these problems of the technology. They're basically pointing out this problem, that technology is temporary.
Yeah, for me too. I mean, some of the works, somebody would ask, for instance, if Namjoon Paik's Buddha looking at himself in the monitor, that CRT monitor is going to die. And the question is, when it does and no CRT monitors are ever fabricated again, would Namjoon Paik have sort of agreed to show that same project with a flat screen? Because it would be very important to have asked him, is it about the circularity of vision of Buddha just sort of observing himself, or is the cabinet that important? And the only person who would have the answer to that is Namjoon Paik. So if he says, no, the cabinet dies, the project dies, that needs to be respected. And that happens in some of my projects. I have this project similar to Pulse Park where it's incandescent light bulbs that actually show the heartbeat. And I've made it clear to potential collectors that the moment that those light bulbs are no longer available, as you know, they're being phased out all over the world, then the project needs to die, because I am very married to that actual tungsten filament, that bulb, that iconic figure. On the other hand, like a project like MoMA's, it's really about that actual instruction. So what I've done is when I gave the piece to MoMA, I gave him like a big manual saying, well, what kind of tolerances are there? For instance, I gave them spare screens. This is shown in small liquid crystal displays. I said, here are the spares. Here's the company that makes them in Italy. When they go bankrupt, here's how they can be replaced. And the only restrictions I've made is they have to be small, because I care for people to get close to them and for it to look like a detonator. They need to make sound, a little beeping sound. They need to show Spanish characters. So I sort of explain what are the constraints that aesthetically matter to me. And then the future curator can then reperform the piece based on those instructions. So in that sense, it's sort of liberated from that display, so long as it's respected how it's sort of written out in the manual.
Other questions? Yes.
I'm interested in what MoMA's strategy is in terms of collecting and promoting this work, and also the term new media. I mean, this is sort of an accepted term, but will we have a new media or old new media? Or, you know, it's a little problematic, possibly.
Starting backwards, I think the term new media is very problematic. I mean, even the term media at this point is problematic, since it refers both to journalism in the press, as well as to a technology, but getting past the kind of nomenclature, which will sort itself out over time, I think from the museum's perspective, we're interested in any form of art that's new, progressive, interesting, and provocative. So, in a way, the underlying structure of the art is less interesting than what it's doing and why. So several years ago, we created a department. We had a video, right? We had film and video. And then, of course, that migrated into film and media. That migrated into film and new media, to distinguish it from older media. That's now migrated into media and performing art. And I think it's really important that I think both Corey and Raphael underscored a kind of performative dimension to their work. And I think, you know, we can come back to how central that is, that this is not art that exists in that traditional relationship of an object and a single viewer. It's art that's activated by a kind of social engagement, whether that takes place online, in a public space, or both. And we're collecting as extensively as we can, which is, if I look across the last 4 or 5 years of acquisitions, probably 30 to 50% would fall in the category of new media, technologically based art. And most importantly, and it's a part that I think is central, we're trying to meet, talk to, learn from, and engage artists like Corey and Raphael, because in the end, it doesn't really matter what we think. It matters what they think and what they do, and the degree to which we as an institution can follow them. It's not without coincidence that, you know, we have Pippi Lodi-Riis Pour Your Body Out, which is a immersive, very socially driven piece in our atrium. But it's a piece that couldn't happen without an extensive amount of technology, not just in terms of the delivery, that's straightforward, but also in the kind of coding that's required to tile this vast array of imagery, the software underneath this, to make these images do what they do in that space. other questions or thoughts? Yes, please.
I have a question that sort of builds off the language question. And as you both said, that you have, there's larger audiences and that more and more artists are showing their work on the web. I was wondering how that is affecting the language you use to talk about your work and that critics and curators use to talk about your work.
All right, your turn.
Just give me a second. I got to replay that. That's a very good question. Well, first, I guess I'd like to point out that like some of the things that I've done, you know, maybe when I started doing them maybe 10 years ago, there was like something like this would never happen, you know. So first of all, there's been a shift in these things. A lot of the things I do online are really for online, and so meaning they're, while they're engaged in a dialogue around art, they're, I think on things online, there's this new, there's new people making stuff, you know, and they may or may know not about art history, and there's a new audience that is interested in interesting things, you know, and may or may know about art history, and so, and I was participating in that new area. So one, you know, the institutions have moved over, which is great, and the language, you know, how does all this new stuff affect the way I talk about it? That's a very good question. I have no real answer. Hold on, I'm going to give you an answer. I just have to think about it. How does all this? I don't know. Like, you mean like, so now that there's all these people making all this crazy stuff on YouTube, how did it? How does it affect I talk about my crazy stuff?
I think every day we now see tech lingo flowing into marketing campaigns, and people are using more and more technical terms to talk about more and more everyday experiences. And so I'm sort of interested in the language that's evolving and whether that's sort of, I guess, the term lowbrow or highbrow, mm-hmm. and then also just the concepts that you are attempting to communicate.
Mm-hmm. I think that, first we'll talk about the concepts. The concepts that I have, basically my concepts are getting more and more simple as the audience and the people online. Because what I find that all these people online are shifting towards, like, you can go online and find what 10 years ago would have been like a violently progressive video. There is some 11-year-old kid and he's doing some crazy editing, and, you know, 10, 20 years ago he would have been a real major figure, you know. And so while that is shifting this way, I'm also shifting towards that. So I'm maybe making my work more in these vernacular styles in order to kind of secretly place it amongst this thing, you know. And that works wonderful on the net, because on the net there is no context. There is no art context. Nobody knows I'm an artist, or a lot of the people who will see my stuff on YouTube, or, well, I don't have much stuff on YouTube, but you get the idea. And I guess the way I talk about it, yeah, I mean, I'm able to roll up to things like this and talk computer stuff, and no one even bats an eyelash anymore, where 10 years ago it would have been impossible. So maybe that's the answer. That's my answer.
Raphael? Yeah. I think that specialized languages are really important. I think that it's really important for new media. Somebody was mentioning this word new media. It really cringes. Everybody that I know hates this term, because this sort of assumption of originality is ridiculous. I mean, it's always more interesting to see how we're connected to the past experimentation, which I find much more rewarding. But at the same time, specializing your language in terms of, say, art history, or specializing in terms of nerdy new lingo with technology or whatever, are just ways to establish relationships with a community. So in fact, many people say, well, that kind of talk actually sort of alienates the general public. Well, it doesn't. It connects you to other specialists. To me, what's important is that there be a panorama of different specializations, multiple entry points, that the artwork should be able to
if anyone's curious, have certain sort of art historical reasoning or thought. Technologically, nerd-wise, it needs to, you know, stand its own ground. So if people see it as a special effect, that's fine. If people see it as a continuation of Shadowplay, that's fine. You know, like, that you give several entry points into the piece. That would be the important thing. But I would say that specialization, the specific lingo of it, be it art historical or technological, they're not mutually exclusive. It's good to have that.
Other questions? Well, I think we should thank both Corey and Raphael for sharing an evening with us and for giving us the kinds of insights into work that is endlessly fascinating and always developing. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.